Hello everyone, this is Philosophy with People with Ben Burgess and Stephen Bertram. People will often ask on Reddit, Ask Philosophy, like, why aren't there any philosophers anymore? To which the response is, I mean, there are. But then people will come back, well, why aren't there philosophers who are big as Hume or Kant or whatever? And instead, these are all people from the past. To which the answer partially comes from kind of, you know, these philosophers' legacies are played out, while the legacies of 21st century philosophers obviously aren't. But seeing as he has unfortunately died, I wanted to say that I do think that Daniel Dennett will be remembered on the level of someone like Hume in the end.
Yeah, I want to write something about Dennett for next week, especially because I just read an obituary of Dennett in the New York Times that made me really angry because
they fucked it completely.
Yeah, they like had like really basic misunderstandings of like some of his most important views.
Dennett directly backwards.
Yeah. Like it sort of, they basically mixed up his position on consciousness with the church lens, and they said he didn't believe in free will, which is amazing. You know, one of the world's most famous compatibilists. Yeah.
I do think he'll be remembered in a similar way to Hume, in that he'll be completely misunderstood, like as some kind of skeptic about very basic things. In the same way that Hume is taking as a skeptic of inductive reasoning, despite that being more or less the opposite of the case.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, I think that I would certainly read Hume as a kind of, you know, certainly like an externalist about some kinds of knowledge, but that's very different from being a skeptic, right? I mean, like in the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, he raises all these skeptical problems about our knowledge of causation and induction, but then says, you know, only like this word for word, only a fool or a madman would actually think that we didn't have these things, right? So yeah. Like I think the most natural reading is that he's, you know, he thinks that we do, you know, he just doesn't think that we sort of have full internal access to how we do. And if you don't read him that way, it's very hard to make sense of a lot of his most famous arguments because,
yeah, like against miracles.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like he clearly believes that we have knowledge of cause and effect, physical laws, you know, the stuff about miracles, the liberty and necessity chapter about determinism, and the stuff about determinism and Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. Like all of this stuff is incomprehensible if you don't believe that he thinks that we have knowledge about causation. You know, he just seems to be some kind of externalist about it. So, you know, and I think the Hume comparison is probably a pretty good one for Dennett because, you know, look, whatever criticisms you have of some of Dennett's views, I've got plenty, but like, you know, these are both guys you cannot possibly fault for not being clear. Like, if you know, I mean, if you read like, you know, Kant at his densest and get, you know, and get what he thinks totally wrong, like, okay, fair enough, I get it, right? You know, but like,
I mean, Dennett does do the thing of using a word in a weird way, but he does tell you exactly what he's about to do that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like by illusion, Dennett means something which is real but not in the way you think it is, while normal illusion word means like not real at all, but maybe, I mean, it's not entirely kind of off because with an illusion, you know, there's generally some kind of basis for it to be illusion, like something which is causing it to be an illusion, but it's not quite what Dennett means by it.
Yeah. But like, I mean, just in general, I mean, part of the reason that Dennett is somebody who is, you know, widely read by people who aren't academics in philosophy is that he actually has a really engaging style, both writing and speaking. And, you know, even if he does some weird non-standard word usage, it's not like you're doing like, you know, dented exegesis later to try to figure out what he meant by the word. I mean, like, there'll literally just be a sentence where he lays out, here's what I mean.
I mean, and definitely like Elbow Room beats like The First Critique is a name.
Yeah, yeah.
Elbow Room's a great one.
Yeah.
He is mentioned in your essay this week, but as an aside, is included with some less admirable characters.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that actually. So I was at, night before last. So Dennett had, the news had been announced that day, I think. And I was out at a friend who's a philosophy academic person at their birthday party in Long Beach, and we were talking with one other philosophy person there about Dennett, and one thing that we did all agree on is that he was by far the least objectionable of the four horsemen, right, of New Atheism, because you have Sam Harris, who just has like a sort of who has like just a kind of total wrongness that's like sort of impressive in a way that like Sam Harris gets, nearly everything wrong.
Seriously engaged with philosophy, but only badly.
yeah, exactly. Right.
As well as the Dawkins, who probably didn't try.
Yeah. That seems right. Right. That Harris like has strong views on all these philosophical topics, but they're all kind of dumb views. And more importantly, I mean, some of them are views that, I disagree with, but like, I think that like, there are people who make serious arguments for, he's just not one of them. Right. Like, he's like the Harris stuff about, free will, a lot of his conclusions are very similar to like Derek Paraboom. Particularly the stuff about how to think about punishment if there's no free will and all that. But he just does a silly version of it. Right. It's just very badly argued. Metaethics, you can be like somebody who has a sort of naturalist, like utilitarian view about that morality, just on some level, moral facts just are facts about happiness and unhappiness. And, there are people who can sort of run, again, I don't agree with it, but there are people who can run some kind of argument for it. That's like, okay, I think that deserves a hearing, but again, he's just very much not one of them. I mean, he makes just totally ludicrous arguments for it would it be bad if everybody was in hell? Well, then you think they agree that morality is only about happiness. Like, they're just these bizarre logical leaps. And of course, he's a neocon, right? Like this is, Harris, he was like in oftentimes in sort of a cowardly way where he would like do Maude and Bailey games about, what exactly he was saying, but,
I support incredibly strangely impossible to occur philosophical defenses of torture. And that means actually what we're doing in Iraq is fine.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, He would say, oh, well, I'm just doing, philosophical edge cases. But then, like, you'd look at the original thing and he'd be like, yeah, we may have to use torture in our current war on terror. Like, you're clearly offering views for the real world. Or my favorite from the end of Faith, that, gosh, it would be sad, but we might just have to commit nuclear genocide in Iran. which is, I always loved Michael Brooks's thing about that, where, like the nuclear thought experiment at the end of Faith, where, you know, where, you know, I think there's a much more polite version of this that made it into Against the Web, but the sort of, when we were working on the book, like the sort of much funnier verbal version that Michael kept doing was like, look, I'm not saying I'm going to do this, but I'm just saying, isn't it interesting to consider the hypothetical possibility that I might have to kill you and fuck your wife? I mean, like, no. Why are you mad? Like, I'm just saying, this is like a, you know, isn't this an interesting scenario to consider that I might have to do that, which actually I might have to do.
It is also amazing how for neocons, it's like Iran, fundamentalist Muslims who can't be defeated by anything below nuclear weapons. But Saudi Arabia are our good friends.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, yeah, somehow the Saudis, they're fine, right? Like, the yeah, no, absolutely. Which is also like, come on, man, which one of these groups, one of these two countries has actually been, you know, I mean, they lost, like,
spread like Al-Qaeda ideology across the world by opening like a Wahhabiist schools in literally every fucking place on the planet.
Yeah, exactly. And like also just in terms of, you know, damage to the world. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, past tense only insofar as they lost, but I mean, like they really did do to Yemen things that are very much on the level of you know, Gaza now. I mean, this is,
yeah, I mean, I was thinking right now, it was very similar with Gaza up to including like them basically not being able to win despite everyone thinking they should have.
So yeah, like Harris just like irredeemable. Dawkins we'll get to, but not great. And you know, Christopher Hitchens, certainly many redeeming features that Harris and Dawkins lack, but also, you know, he supported the Iraq War. So, you know, you have to get a few million demerits for that. And then Dennett, it's like, yeah, Dennett's fine. Like that's the, like as his, in his sort of capacity as a new atheist, it's like, yeah, no, he didn't, you know, he didn't call for nuking Iran. He didn't, you know, like he didn't do anything like that at all.
As far I don't as think like, I've ever seen a political statement from Dennett.
No, he seems to be totally apolitical. In fact, there's a book called The Four Horsemen, which is just like a transcript of like a long conversation between the four of them, where there's even a line in there where it's like he's very quiet about it, but he's like, you know, he's kind of like, well, I don't even remember the context completely, but I remember being struck by the line where Dennett's like, yeah, but I mean, Islam's like no worse than any other, right?
Yeah.
so yeah, like, you know, seemed to be pretty apolitical, and yeah, certainly didn't take his new atheist rule in any of the dumb directions that at various times the other three all to one extent or another did. And he even tried his level best to explain to Sam Harris what compatibilism was. So, you know, like, basically benign.
Oh, behavior. I was going to say, Ben, this is going to be my opening joke, but I forgot. Do you know what Dennett's last public appearance was?
No, I actually don't.
Jordan Peterson interview.
Oh, that makes sense, because that was just like a few weeks ago.
Yeah. It was 11 days ago.
Yeah. Alpha... God damn it, you've got to get a shorter name for this. Anyway... that guy says in one of his books, he called himself an ACLU liberal. Actually, interestingly enough, he might have had, even though he didn't really publicly pronounce on politics much, he might have had slightly better sympathies than that. So the two things I know point in opposite directions, but one, you know, apparently, like his... So his dad was in the CIA and he had like he partially grew up in like Beirut because like his dad was doing CIA stuff there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I believe his dad this, I mean, the story as I heard it, right? This is just something somebody told me the other night. So check this. But like, I believe his dad is like the, when the CIA, like, cause there's the OSS and then the CIA, when they started doing like the stars for like the CIA agents who died in line of duty. Apparently Dennett Sr. was like the first star, and he may have even had something. He may have even had something to do with one of the, installing the Shah. So, you know, the Dennett family overall, right, may have had a very bad impact in the world. But on the other hand, I will say, I think I can say this. I don't feel bad violating the privacy of the recently deceased when, you know, it reflects well on them. A friend of mine showed me a email he'd sent to Dennett where he was like, hey, given that Jerry Cohen talks about functional explanations and Karl Marx's theory of history, do you think that, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Do you have, do you think that like tools from the Dennettian toolbox could be used to help, you know, make sense of analytical Marxism? And Dennett's response was like surprisingly positive. I mean, he didn't have like a worked out view, but he was like, he was like, it's been a long time since I read any of Cohen's books, but I remember reading his main works with great interest many years ago. I think you may be right. So, cool. Yeah. So it's possible that there were some sort of socialist sympathies in there somewhere, but like, you know, whatever, even at the worst reading, you know, he seems to have been, you know, thoroughly inoffensive politically, which is much better than you can say about his three friends.
Today we're talking about Dawkins' Christian sympathies, which is a sad place to end up.
I know. So yeah, Dawkins had said, yes, indeed, something that cannot be said for the other horse people. So Dawkins has been in the news, and I will note that he only ever seems to be in the news these days when he said something dumb. Like, he used to be all over, you know, the discourse. You know, I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the essay, you know, the example I always think about is there's a old episode of Family Guy, you know, from the New Atheism era, where Brian, you know, has like a meet cute with one of his girlfriends because they're both reaching for the same copy of The God Delusion at Barnes and Noble, right? So it's like, you know, this is like he used to be everywhere. You know, he and the other horse people were celebrities at one time, but now they're sort of, you know, Dawkins is sort of treated more as a sort of, oh yeah, you remember this guy, right? Well, he just said something dumb.
He's getting goofy on Twitter. Yeah,
exactly.
What was that one where it's like, I saw an out and homeless guy, and he didn't have a sign asking for money. He had a sign saying, I need a fat bitch. What could this mean?
I mean, much like the point earlier about people misinterpreting Hume and Dennett, I think that the man's been pretty clear about his request.
Yeah, I think there's clear inductive evidence for what he wants.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, he's telling you. But no, his Twitter is amazing. I mean, my all-time favorite is his review of Kafka's Metamorphosis. Kafka's Metamorphosis is called a major work of literature. Why? If it's science fiction, it's bad science fiction. If, like Animal Farm, it's an allegory of what? Scholarly answers range from pretentious Freudian to far-fetched feminist. I don't get it. Where are the emperor's clothes? So,
I mean, this just indicates again that Animal Farm is with babies. If you could get that.
I mean, I guess Kafka really should have had Gregor Samsa like say at the end, break the fourth wall and say, just to be really clear,
right? I'm Leon Trotsky.
Spell out the that's how literature should work, right? Like there should be a very neat lesson that is explicitly explained to the reader So there's no confusion about it whatsoever. So awesome. But yeah, the there's
those in the Bible.
Yeah, right. There you go. Most recently, Dawkins has been in the news for a set of comments he made about Ramadan being celebrated on Oxford Street, which the sort of takeaway that people like was sort of most discussed in the news was his use of the phrase cultural Christian to describe himself, which I actually think is like sort of the least crazy part of it. Like, look, there are things you could mean by that that are fine, right? Like that's, this is kind of like, even Hitchens, right? In his memoir, Hitch 22, he has a line, and I think it's, there's like a footnote about this where he sort of jokingly refers to himself as a Protestant atheist and says about his brother, Peter, that I can just about imagine Peter becoming an atheist, but I can't imagine him being a Catholic. It's like sort of saying like, if it's like the equivalent of calling yourself like a secular Jew, right? Like then like I can understand perfectly
well. Yeah. Like kind of just copying to what you were made into.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. That's fine. Right. I mean, just sort of saying like, yeah, this is my cultural background, even though I don't believe any of it. And that's sort of unobjectionable as far as it goes. If all you're getting at is that you're, you know, like raised in a Christian environment and you continue to enjoy, you know, Christmas carols or whatever, then like, sure. Great. Right. You know, but, and in fact, you know, Dawkins has used the phrase many times before and sometimes in ways that seem to just kind of mean that, right? But I think the thing that was striking about his most recent comments is that he didn't, you know, like he said that his identity as a cultural Christian, he was relating this to him being slightly horrified by Oxford Street in London promoting Ramadan rather than Easter. And in explaining this, he said that Christianity is a, quote, fundamentally decent, unquote, religion, while Islam is not, and justified this contrast by saying that the holy books of Islam are hostile to women and gays, which...
They're like 60% the same book.
Yeah, right? Like...
In one of them, Jesus Christ... Sorry, not Jesus Christ. Jesus of Galilee.
Yeah, Jesus the prophet.
Whoever
right?
he
yeah.
might have been. Died on the cross. Sorry, ascended, did not die on the cross, and ascended directly to heaven then. In the other one, he did die on the cross, and then ascended into heaven about 30 days later. And that, my friends, is worth fighting nuclear war over.
yeah, exactly.
And also, especially with Ramadan and Lent, they're the same fucking thing.
Yeah, no, very much the same idea.
They have like a 4-week overlap normally of just people doing the same thing.
Christians and Muslims being irritable because they've denied themselves things that they enjoy. They're very, very similar. As you say, in Islam, Jesus is a great prophet, but not the son of God, and you know, whatever. But like, it's not, these are obviously religions that share an awful lot of DNA, including, by the way, their sort of problematic aspects on the very subjects that Dawkins mentioned. So like the whole thing is, so, okay. I mean, just on the most obvious level, okay, I don't really think that like Christianity or Islam is in some like essential way, you know, committed to sort of reactionary cultural politics on, you know, gender or, you know, sexuality, if only just because all of these religious traditions are so vast.
Plenty of them don't, especially on the Christian side, right? So. It seems just a bit silly to try and insert.
Yeah. I mean, they're like the traditions and their texts and, you know, like the way the texts have been interpreted by different people over the course of thousands of years. It's all such a vast, sprawling, self-contradictory mess that there's tons of material there that you could find to come to any number of different conflicting conclusions about any of these subjects, right? Like that if you want to, you know, if you want to justify, you know, if you want to find justification, you know, for being like a, you know, like a socially progressive Christian, you know, then, you know, you can find, you know, you can find stuff there, you know, if you want to find justification for being an insane fundamentalist misogynist, you can find tons of justification there, right? Like there's a,
I think the books almost always kind of favor the reactionaries, but that doesn't necessarily imply much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if we're just talking about like sort of biblical source texts or Quranic source texts, you can find way more from, you know, on the bad side, right, of both of those. But I just think it's worth sort of like, that's true, that's fine. But like, I also think that like, it just is a fact that all of this stuff has been interpreted and reinterpreted to death by different people with different agendas, that some of the source texts themselves are, you know, I guess not with the Quran, although even there with the Hadiths and all that, you start to get into this, like that certainly with the Bible, you know, you have lots of different authors at different times and different agendas. And certainly when you get into interpretive traditions, you have those things. And, you know, I do think that it's a bit silly as an atheist to be like, oh, here's the correct interpretation of this. Cause it's like, well, I mean, what makes it correct? Right. Well, especially
like, it's always coincidentally like the worst one.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, man. I have it seems like, you know, given the premise that these are sort of historically contingent human inventions, then, you know, there's sort of, yeah, look, I think you can use the language of this tradition to say lots of different things. And I'm not really that interested in sort of, essentializing any of it. Right. But that said, if we're going to play that game with the Quran, let's be consistent, right. And play it with the Bible too. And, you know, if you're going to say, yeah, the Quran and the Hadiths have like lots of material to support the sort of conclusions about women and gays that Dawkins is worried about, that's like, well, look, it's not like the Bible isn't full of that stuff, right? Like, I mean, as you say, the Quran is mostly, you know, a lot of it's cribbed from there anyway, right? Like
if we're doing like Hadith stuff, then like there's plenty of statements from church fathers, early church fathers, who are like, no, Jesus didn't mean treat women nicely and give away all your money, don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's, you know, I would think
camel and the needle are just metaphors.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 They have, when Jesus said, this is my body and this is my blood, that was literal. But when he said, give away your money, that was a metaphor. There's tons of biblical misogyny and condemnation of same-sex acts and all that stuff. There's tons of that stuff. Any hellfire preacher would be happy to quote it for you. And I would have thought any Richard Dawkins-style militant atheist would be happy to quote it for you. Right? I'm sure he has, right? What is he doing? And all I can conclude is that he's just kind of repositioning himself in the culture war, that they, that times have changed pretty considerably from when new atheism was a thing.
I'm looking at the God delusion now, and in chapter 8, which is called What's Wrong with Religion? Why Be So Hostile? There's a section which is called Faith and Homosexuality.
Right. I'm sure that chapter is full
about how nice they are.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to be about how actually real Christians are all for gay rights. That is not going to be the conclusion of that chapter. It's so fucking silly, and I think that I think in a lot of ways this kind of feels to me like, you know, if new atheism was like, you know, a sort of piece of cultural roadkill that you weren't sure was quite dead yet, right? This kind of feels like the last twitch, you know, that like, okay, that's that, right? That's all she wrote. And you know, I don't particularly mourn it, but I do think it's interesting to think about the contrast between this sort of high profile public atheism we got, right? That was encapsulated by figures like Richard Dawkins, and you know, a sort of let's say a not too distant timeline where we can imagine public atheism that's high profile looking very different, right? That like, and I think there are probably very explicable reasons we got what we got and not the better one, but you know, I get into that at the end, but like, I think that in a certain sense, it was always possible that we could have gotten something way better than this, which is where, you know, I think of the late Quentin Smith, who is somebody who, you know, who had in certain respects kind of anticipated that new atheist moment, but just, you know, in a vastly smarter way, you know, than any of those people really did. I mean, you know, like I said, I think obviously Dennett is, you know, was by far the best of the four, but like, you know, although also maybe the least high profile of the four, right? That at the time that, you know, there were no, you know, like, Daniel Dennett was never a character on South Park, right? That's, you know, that never happened. Like, you know, he seemed to sort of capture the imagination, you know, much less than the other three, in particular, much less than Hitchens and Dawkins did. I think Quentin Smith is somebody who, you know, like several years before the sort of beginning of the new atheist moment, you know, I mean, the thing that, you know, when I switched to talking about Smith in the essay, it's the first thing I mention is he was like the guest speaker at the Atheist Alliance convention in 1996. And, you know, if you read his speech that I link there and, you know, quote a bunch of in the essay, it's, you know, it's still available online. It's in, you know, it's all done in a very, you know, very popular, very accessible, you know, kind of way, you know, but I think that, but it's just sort of really strange to read it thinking about what we actually got with Dawkins and co. Since.
Yeah, there were some fresh arguments you highlighted that I hadn't heard of before that were interesting.
Yeah. Like he, you know, cause yeah, it's a combination of sort of actually fresh and original with, you know, more standard kinds of arguments, but it's all like, you know, in a certain sense, it's militant atheism because it's sort of very like, it's very like argumentatively aggressive atheism, but what it's really not is like politicized anti-theism, right? I don't get the sense that Quentin gave a shit about politics, you know, at all, really, right? Like, you know, he was really only interested in philosophy. And so, you know, that is like between that and the fact that, you know, he's actually making distinctive arguments, you know, it's really, you know, it really makes you regret that much more that, you know, what we got was Dawkins going on about the flying spaghetti monster and how, you know, there are more Nobel prizes from Trinity College and, you know, Oxford than the entirety of the Muslim world.
Which is like presumably a brilliant argument for Judaism.
that's true too, right? Like, that's probably, yeah, good call.
Wow, it turns out that the Jews really are the chosen people. There really was a covenant with Abraham, and it's all true.
Yeah, exactly. All the Nobel Prizes prove it. Whereas Quentin's actually, even in that popular speech for the atheist convention, is actually making really interesting points. Like, he is, you know, he's talking about William Lane Craig's version of the first cause argument. On the sort of basic level, you know, if the first cause argument, you know, like if the, the sort of easiest to understand version would be to say, well, everything has to have a cause. The universe has to have a cause. Of course, there's a good reason that no philosopher who actually writes it down says that, because by the time you get to the point of writing it down, you probably realize that that doesn't work. Because, you know, I always kind of think, like, give this to, like, interest students, that this is sort of the philosophical equivalent of that intelligence test for dogs where, you know, you have, like, you put a blanket over them and see how many seconds it takes for them to shake it off, right? It's like, how many seconds does it take to get to the obvious response, which is, well, hold on, if everything has to have a cause, then God has to have a cause. So you know, Craig's version, you know, which is not, this is not a original move to him, but he's just the sort of most important living exponent of it, is to say, well, everything that begins to exist has a cause of its existence. And this sounds very, you know, superficially plausible, right? I mean, if I say, you know, I don't know, hold up this book, this is the Eric Olin Wright Visionary Real Utopias, in my left hand, right? If an identical copy popped into existence in my right hand, that would be very surprising. You'd want an explanation. You wouldn't just accept that sometimes things like that happen.
You would assume I'm the sick video editor.
Yeah. But Quentin makes a really interesting point about this, which is that what is Craig doing here? He's trying to appeal to our everyday experience, like our day-to-day experience and our knowledge of science to get us to believe this principle about causation. But then he says, what does cause actually mean here? Because when you talk about one thing causing another thing to come into existence, or for that matter, you talk about coming into existence, in every everyday case and, you know, almost all scientific cases, what are we actually talking about there, right? We're talking about matter being rearranged in some way, right? Whether, you know, whether that's like, the book comes into existence, right? You know, it's the, you know, the matter from, you know, a tree, right? You know, being rearranged in various ways, or, you know, the more complicated way that matter is rearranged to make new human beings, you know, et cetera, right? Like, if you're talking about the universe as a whole being caused to come into existence by a immaterial infinite mind, then it sounds like you're actually talking about something totally different. That you know, it's, you know, we're using the same words, but I mean, it's you're not talking about the same thing as just like matter being rearranged in new ways. And notice that none of our everyday experience has anything to do with that, right? Like, and you know, the scientific theories for which we have the most evidence, etc., like none of it, right? Like, none of it has anything to do with that. So you're, you know, like this principle that you think is just obvious, well, it's obvious, it sounds obvious, because when you say it, we're thinking about one thing, right? Yeah. But then you're then trying to apply it to this completely new thing that's like a very stretched analogy to the first thing. So he says, look, I just don't see any reason to believe this, right? You need to give me some kind of evidence for whatever kind of principles you want to apply to this, because the evidence from science and everyday experience doesn't cut it in this case.
Right. You need evidence for that sort of thing to be like, you know, if there was wizards who could create ex nihilo, but had to do like not things couldn't just purely be ex nihilo. There had to be like a certain cause for it to happen. Like a wizard had to do a certain spell or whatever for it to come into being. That would be evidence that everything kind of like, and there was no other way of creating these sort of things. That would be evidence for the same sort of totally. Thing is God creating ex nihilo. But sadly, we do not live in such a world.
Yeah, right. There are no wizards, or at least none discovered just yet. But
none of them are good at it.
no competent wizards have thus far been discovered. Yeah, exactly. Like, and you know, he has, and I don't, and like, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, he also. So in another paper where he's talking about first cause arguments, he makes a really fun point with that you could take the sort of William Lane Craig version of the cosmological argument and just like, let's say for the sake of argument, you accept every single premise and every single inference and all that stuff. All right, fantastic. The universe as a whole has to have a cause. Could just be the Big Bang singularity. Why can't that be the first cause of everything? You know, it's the sort of zero dimensional space time point, you know, that expands into everything. It actually meets a lot of the right criteria, etc. And you know, he has, you know, and like there's another one where he, you know, he talks about, you know, fine tuning, and he, you know, he makes the point that, well, hold on, you know, if the, like, there's a real problem with taking fine tuning, the idea, which, yeah, we've talked about before, but for anybody who never watched any of those, just really quickly, the idea that, the sort of physical constants like gravitation and electron mass that, you know, of our universe just happen to be in exactly this insanely narrow range they need to be for life to be possible. And Smith in various papers makes two really fun points about this. One of them, which is actually really interesting because it sort of anticipates, I think, an argument more famously made many years later by Neil Sinibabu, a paper called Electrons in Love, where Smith says, hey, you could, like, if by the same token that there could have been a, like, this dizzying array of physical constants, why do we think that the psychophysical bridge laws, could only be a certain way, right? Like that this is, you know, what sort of arrangements of matter give rise to consciousness, you know, could only be one way, right? Like maybe that it's, you know, right. Maybe
if God could will everything that isn't logically possible, then it seems that, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You could have sentient black holes, right? Like it's not,
so it seems like you didn't really fine tune much.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, if you're assuming that like biological life, right, as we would, you know, think of it, is what's necessary for consciousness, then the fine-tuning argument is much more, you know, has much more initial plausibility than if you're just thinking about, than if you think that, well, look, you could have, you could have consciousness in a radically different universe, like, you know, whatever could be conscious, right? You know, it's sort of helpful, I think, here if anybody's ever seen the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once, to think about the universe where all that exists is like an empty landscape and a couple of rocks, and the rocks are having a conversation, right? As a sort of symbol of this. But yeah, so that's fun. But he also has one that I really like where he's talking about Richard Swinburne's version of the fine tuning argument. And he says, let's think about this. Swinburne says that, he rolls out some probabilistic machinery here. And, the first draft of the paper, I quoted that part and then, my friend Mark, who I'd sent it to for comments, was like, no, you can't do this without like actually pausing to explain this. So like I just summarize it instead. But like he says, look, to whatever extent you think fine tuning raises the probability of the existence of God in the sense that Swinburne means an all powerful, all, you know, all knowing, all good being, all PKG, to exactly the same extent, it raises the probability of, right? Confirms in that sense, the existence of a malevolent God, or, you know, one that's at least, you know, considerably less than omnibenevolent. So to whatever extent the fine tuning and evidence is evidence in favor of the one, it's equally evidence in favor of the other. And when the same evidence equally confirms two hypotheses, then you need to break the tie with something else. And hey, what else could do it? How about the evidence of the apparently pointless suffering of innocence that is absolutely pervasive throughout the world of living things? That seems to do it. So, you know, so what are you doing if you're just following the evidence where you lead? If you assume for the sake of argument, which of course Smith doesn't actually think, but if you assume for the sake of argument that this that fine tuning, you know, gives us a good reason to believe in a supernatural creator, then it shouldn't be an omnibenevolent one, right? It should be a very different kind of of creator, which, you know, is also the subject of, you know, my favorite maybe Quentin Smith argument about philosophy of religion, which is where he says, you know, he introduces the paper with an anecdote about, you know, he was staying in like a cabin in the middle of the woods, which is the kind of thing that he did. I should say, you know, full disclosure here, Quentin Smith was one of my professors in my master's program at Western Michigan, you know, decades ago. I'm very old. And this is, you know, he...
Because remembering, I giggled earlier when you were talking about condemning the Iraq War. So I was remembering we were talking about how the fact I was saying I supported it, but I was 8 year old at the time. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're forgiven. Yeah, this is I wrote an article when Quentin died. I linked there. People can read if they sort of want to read about the man's immense number of, you know, of personal eccentricities. But yeah, he was staying in a cabin in the woods and he heard some, you know, animal hunting and killing another animal in the woods outside, and was really disturbed by it. And he made the point that's like, look, if you want to sort of stark example of a, you know, of for the problem of evil, this is a really perfect one, because it's not a one-off occurrence. It's not, you know, it has nothing to do with free will, right? You know, no weaseling out of it that way. It's not, you know, like, I mean, in some ways it's like there's a classic paper by William Rowe about you know, the problem of evil and kinds of atheism, where he has this example about like a, you know, a deer in the forest who's, you know, struck, you know, like there's a lightning strike that, you know, that ends up, you know, incinerating the tree, that incinerates the deer. And he's like, surely things like this happen, and so how can you explain this by any of the standard moves to explain the problem of evil? And Quentin's point here would be like, look, forget the one-off weird occurrence about the lightning strike. This is the entire history of living things, right? You know, you like, or at least once it reaches a certain level of complexity, you have natural laws that, that, you know, have the effect of requiring some sentient creatures capable of, you know, pain and pleasure to brutally kill and eat others in order to survive. I mean, this is maybe like
the sort of... It is kind of funny hearing these arguments from people who are presumably omnivores.
Well, I don't know, actually, in his case.
Yeah, I don't know.
He was... At one point, he had a diet that was definitely vegetarian, but I don't know. I don't think that was for moral reasons. I think that was just for sort of bizarre personal reasons.
I mean, especially back in the day, it was like people would go vegetarian for health reasons, and it wasn't really clear what those health reasons were or why it would improve it, but it was just health reasons.
Yeah. It's probably a really bad reason to do it, because whereas, you know, you are, you know, when I've had, like, you know, students in ethics classes reflect on like Peter Singer's argument that everybody should be vegetarian, you know, I'll often see them try to take refuge in health reasons why you have to eat meat, which is actually probably a little bit more plausible, although also pretty fucking silly. Cause like, there's there are obviously a multitude of very healthy and long lived.
It's even like, you know, say there's a 22% health gain from not eating meat, and then you have to kill like 500 animals a year to live. It's like, well, this the math isn't mathing here.
Yeah, exactly.
We're clear to everyone. I'm also an omnivore. I just don't think animal lives matter.
Sure. I actually think they do. I'm just a hypocrite. But,
which is in some ways more admirable, in other ways less.
Yeah, exactly. So he's also, like, to sort of bring it around full circle to where we start, you know, where we, you know, started after the Remember and Dead It, you know, by talking about Dawkins, it's really, I think that.
I thought you were about to sneeze.
In certain respects, it's very easy to imagine Quentin slotting into the same kind of role. In fact, he debated some of the very same people, like William Craig, although sadly mostly before the invention of YouTube, because we're talking about stuff that happened in the late 90s or very early 2000s. He did going on TV to talk about this stuff, you know, to a certain extent, like on PBS. They did like a series that he was on. And, you know, he was actually good at sort of doing these things in like pithy, accessible ways. He he did also have like a certain kind of panache for like playfully fighting about stuff like this. I mean, I sort of, I remember, like, something I mentioned, you know, from when I was going to Western Michigan, there was another graduate student who was a theist. He'd had he was like a former Protestant seminarian. And there's a collection of essays by Quentin Smith and William Lane Craig, like sort of battling back and forth essays about the first cause argument. Basically, it's called Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology. And and so my friend got both men to sign his copy of the book, and, you know, and Craig, in his inscription, he included a biblical quotation complete with chapter and verse. So, you know, not to be outdone, Quentin included in his a quotation from the Genealogy of Morals complete with the page number. And, you know, this is, which also, man had a freakishly good memory, but he had, you know, like, or like he has like some really fun lines in that Atheist Alliance address where he's talking about, you know, the problem of evil. And essentially, I think this might've been before the word was coined. I'm not actually too sure about that, but he's talking about essentially what we now think of as Mysterianism, you know, which is, the idea, or no, sorry, Mysterianism, that's philosophy of mind. He's talking about skeptical theism, right? So what we now call skeptical theism, I think there are ways to make that sound more plausible, but he is essentially having a lot of fun making fun of it, where, you know, he sort of says, like, look, you could say, you know, that there's, you know, an all PKG being would have good reasons to allow immense amounts of suffering to happen, but we're just not smart enough to figure it out. Right. It's a big mystery. And he says, yeah, okay. But I could say that I'm really, you know, 100 feet tall and I only appear to be 6 feet tall. And it's a big mystery why I appear to be that, you know, like, you know, you could say, I remember this is the end of the address, that, you know, Elvis Presley is alive and well, shaking his hips on the dark side of the moon. And, you know, that, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, I mean, I suppose that could be true, right? We could concoct a scenario, right? But, like, does the evidence suggest it? And, you know, and I think that it's sort of, in a certain sense, it's very easy to imagine, you know, to imagine Quentin Smith, doing, you know, like sort of trotting out some of these lines. If you kind of do a global search and replace function for Richard Dawkins, that, you know, you sort of think about Dawkins going on the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News to, you know, snipe back and forth with Bill O'Reilly about whether he was being disrespectful to religious believers, and you put in Quentin and have him, you know, give him that line about Elvis Presley shaking his hips on the dark side of the moon and all that. It's like, it would have a lot of the same fun, but, you know, it would just be, you know, it would just be a vastly smarter version than the people who, like, were, like, one of the striking things about most of the new atheists is that they were all really bad at what one would think would be the core function of an atheist debater, which is arguing about the existence of God. Like,
that's being like evangelicals and the Taliban are bad.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Whereas
evolution is real, which is all those three statements,
all true,
all true, and all also agreed with by the Catholic Church.
Yeah, right, true. Yeah, right, yeah. And if you're gonna toss on also God's not real, then it's like, well, okay, I hear you. Like, you've got a lot to say about the first three points, but now I want to hear more about number four. Right, like,
I'll go with the guys who've got more gold.
That's a really good point. I think that the, you know, you could imagine this much better, much smarter version than, yeah, like, oh my God, the way that those guys would do, like, you know, at their worst, you know, they taught, you know, generations of very online atheist to believe that, you know, you can't give an argument for the non-existence of God because you can't prove a negative, that, like, just all of this, you know, total embarrassing horseshit like that. So you can't imagine this, like, vastly smarter, vastly, you know, sort of philosophically better version of it. And so in a sense, we could have gotten that, right? In a sense, that timeline is not that far away from us. But I also think if we're going to be real about it, it's not just like there was some sort of strange cultural coin flip that happened to come down on the Dawkins side and not the Quentin Smith side. I think that the sort of cultural moment that fed new atheism could only have been satiated with basically something much more like what we got, right? That the, that, you know, somebody who wanted to not just sort of argue, even sort of aggressively and with some swagger, argue that God doesn't exist and we should have, you know, naturalistic ideas about metaphysics, but somebody who, you know, somebody who really wanted to, you know, wage culture war against, you know, right-wing evangelicals and scary Muslims and was appealing to that, right? Because it's like, look, why did we get new atheism when we get? Because it's like, it's, you know, because on a certain sense,
because they were like trying to do creationism in school shit, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, it's because it's like, look, people, it's not a mystery why people would be, lots of people would be interested in the subject. That I think sort of religion and atheism and all of that, I do think is a subject of perennial human interest. They're, you know, have always and will always, or at least will always until such time as like whatever religions or religion-like things people believe in are so different than what we've got that like the terms don't apply anymore. But like, but I think that these are subjects that, you know, lots of people have always been interested in for obvious reasons. They're, you know, they touch on issues of sort of very general human concern, right? Does anything happen when we die? Where does morality come from? All this stuff. How do we get here? But there'll always be people, again, at least as long as like the sorts of religions that we have right now exist, who knows, right? But like there'll always be people who are like raised in super religious homes and are starting to question it. We'll sort of seek out, people who can sort of confirm them in their doubts. But that's all a very different question from why new atheism happened, right? Because that was like, because it's like everything I'm describing, you could say about any point in the last like few hundred years, basically, or, surely many centuries to come. Whereas this was really something that happened during the Bush years and was sort of gradually ran out of steam during the Obama years, right? Like, I think that's about the time frame for new atheism. I think
with the Columbia University hearings, a senator or some shit, I don't know, some fucking American person was talking to the president and was like, in the Bible,
Abraham. Oh my God. No, this is, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's actually way worse. This is not just any fucking American person. This is the Speaker of the House.
Oh no! I thought he was a senator or something, but I guess
he's No, he's not just like he's not just a congressman.
He's the boss.
He's the boss of the House of Representatives. That he said, well, for those he sort of said some like standard kind of neoconish geopolitical things, but then he was like, for those of us who are believing Christians, God has said in the Bible that, he's going to bless nations that help Israel and curse those who, go against it. So it's like, all right. That's
also like an insane kind of interpretation of the covenant of Abraham, which was not about what Gentiles were getting up to.
Yeah. No, this is also true. I guess like the line in the Bible is it something like, bless those who help you and curse those who curse you or something like that. But they have it is also like, honestly, even just in terms of biblical exegesis, it is a bit much to say, that line meant that if there ever happens to be a nation state that's, predominantly Jewish, then like like God is indicating that other nations.
Do you believe that? Like, why are you a Christian?
That's also true.
Like, do you think Jews are just like God's weird side project? Like, I mean, I think that's probably what evangelicals do believe.
I think that is more or less what they think. Yeah, as far as I can tell. Yeah. There's like a, like, I think the sort of defining thing about evangelicals in particular, much more so than other kinds of Christians, when it comes to Christian-Jewish relations, is that they're just absolutely incapable of just being normal about it. Like, they can't, it's like the only options for those people are either like frothing at the mouth anti-Semitism or like the Mike Johnson thing. That's the, or sometimes weird combinations of the two, right? Like that, you just can't just be like, yeah, Jews are fine, whatever, right? Like this, it has to either be like, they're like the devil or it's very important that we like blow up the Temple Mount, so they, blow up the Dome of the Rock, so there can be a second temple. Like the, that's like the, there's no middle of the range.
Is there no one in Israel being like, can we not just build a second one somewhere else? Were the first and the second temple even in the same place?
I think so, at least roughly, but I'm not totally clear on that. But because I think the idea is, okay, so I guess I do know this, right? Because it's like, this is the thing, because supposedly the Temple Mount is where Abraham took Isaac to sacrifice him.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I believe that's correct. Yes, I believe that's right. The chat, correct me if I'm completely misremembering my Old Testament here, but this is part of the reason that it's like, okay, well, just kidding about killing your son, but this is going to be the big important, you know.
Yeah, I only just remember the image of him like holding the knife over his son from my children's illustrated Bible.
Yeah, that's got to scar some children in the children's illustrated Bible. My God. In some ways it's kind of funny, actually. I think that now if there were going to be conditions for, I mean, it doesn't seem to be, which I think is fine. I don't necessarily want it to, but like, if there were conditions for a bit of a new atheist comeback, we might be entering into them between between stuff like that Mike Johnson thing and the fact that we have all these red states that have passed like psychotic anti-abortion laws. And, you know, like I could kind of see it a little bit, but yeah, I mean, the original new atheism, my read on it is it basically came from the convergence of two things, which are, one, the fact that sort of Al-Qaeda style, like Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, was a much greater concern back then and took up a lot more of people's, you know, space in people's heads. And two, the fact that the sort of version of the culture war we had, you know, in the US, and I do realize that, you know, half of the Four Horsemen were British, but, you know, these things tend to be, you know, manufactured here and exported elsewhere, that the culture war as it existed then, it just had a very different shape to it. I think that the sort of standard liberal anxiety about the right in like the late 2000s, mid to late 2000s, when like new atheism really bubbled up in a big way, wasn't so much that, you know, right-wing Republicans are like racist, which is the sort of thing that, you know, it's much more so now, right? Like, it was much more that they're like creepy evangelical theocrats who, you know, who want to, as you say, teach creationism in the public schools and ban abortion and, you know, put gay people back in the closet and all that stuff. And so I think that it was more natural for people who, you know, those anxieties were very big for them. And also everybody was thinking a lot about fundamentalist Islamic terrorism to sort of, you know, which itself was like, I think, sort of refracted through the culture war. Cause is the lesson like, oh, Islam is bad and Christianity is good? Or is the lesson like, religion in general is bad, right? Like that was in some ways, the second one was sort of the lib version of, you know, how to think about the war on terror. And yeah, I think, you know, to the extent that you bought into the clash of civilization stuff. So yeah, I mean, this is like, I think that under those circumstances, it made a lot of sense for people to be focused on this issue in this way. Whereas like, and, you know, again, I think that like somebody like Quentin Smith, who, you know, like ultimately just wanted to argue about the existence of God like a nerd, right, you know, would not have satiated that culture war energy, sadly, who would have been so much better. Well, you know, whereas now it's like, yeah, you know, culture war has changed fundamentally. So even though evangelicals are still, you know, the sort of biggest, most reliable Republican voting base. And even though
we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, I think, where I was saying that, you know, now culture war right wingers are appealing to like science, like the science proves that transgender isn't real, which is like not what anyone would have said in 2002.
Oh my God. No, they would have said, they would have quoted the first chapter of Genesis and male and female, he created them.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like that's how they would have done that. Right. Absolutely, they would not have bothered with this like weird, you know, yeah, with the argument from science. Stuart McGill, we can't put this on the screen because it's in the GTA chat, says this is being controlled. Yeah, R says, if you come across set theory with the different sizes of infinity with the set of natural numbers, one of the smallest infinities. Yes, indeed. Indeed. So I think, yeah, this is, so actually a lot of this stuff about transfinite set theory in the class that I took, well, it wasn't a class, but I did a independent study with Quentin Smith my last semester at Western Michigan. He had like the most insanely generous contract of all time, right? Like when he was hired to, I guess, lure him there, he had to teach like 3 courses per 2 years. So
I don't need grad students.
Yeah, mostly they were just for grad students.
I mean, that's the dream. Like, I don't want to talk to 18-year-olds.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think they might have made him do like 1 of the 3, be like open to upper level undergrads or something. But yeah, this is like, so yeah, normally he would just come in on Monday nights. That was the night he would teach like 3-hour Monday night classes. So he only had to come into campus once a week. And sometimes he would just like, yeah, I mean, he was also, yeah, I get into all this in the obituary, which I link in this essay, but yeah, then he was sort of so strange and unworldly in some ways. Like he would like literally sometimes be like, oh yeah, I forgot what day it was. And you kind of believe him, right? Like it had the ring of truth to it, but yeah. But yes, in this independent study that I took with him my last semester about that book of essays with Craig, The Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, for the thing I wrote, there was a lot of stuff about transfinite set theory in there, because part of Craig's version of the cosmological argument, which is ultimately his version of the Kalam cosmological argument developed by like medieval Islamic philosophers, is saying, well, you can't have an infinite amount of time because there are supposedly these paradoxical things about infinities of like concrete things. And one of my big claims in the paper was just like, well, I mean, if you think about concrete infinities, yeah, they'd be incredibly weird and counterintuitive in lots of ways. Like the classic thing is like Hilbert's hotel, the hotel with the infinite number of rooms and infinite number of guests. Every single room is occupied. A new person comes in off the street and says, do you have any vacancies? And they say, no, but no problem, we've got you. And they just say, all right, we'll move the person who's currently in room. We'll move you into room 1. We'll move the person who was in room 1 into room 2, the person who was in room 2 into room 3, etc. And everybody can, you know, nobody has to share a room. Nobody has to sleep outside, even though every room was already occupied, which sounds incredibly wrong. But this is actually like in terms of like transfinite set theory, this is just correct, right? That this is, you know, if you're imagining an infinite process of people changing rooms, you haven't quite wrapped your mind around how strange it is yet. Cause if we put in an infinite PA system, so it can like, you know, the voice can be piped into all the rooms at once, you could just say, all right, everybody has 5 minutes to move to the next room.
Yeah, yeah, you do in like, yeah, 5 minutes,
yeah.
Whatever. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You'll be done. And that sounds wrong, but you know, and that sounds like, yeah, that's not how reality should work. But my contention, at least in that paper, was like, yeah, okay, it sounds weird, but that's not the same as being paradoxical. It's not like there's nothing inconsistent about this. This is like a perfectly well understood branch of mathematics. It's just weird, right? But like sounding weird isn't the same thing as being, you know, certainly logically impossible. I would, you know, just say our sort of intuitive sense of how quantities should work is formed at the level of dealing with, you know, right, what Quine calls, you know, mid-sized dry goods, right? You know, and
Well, of course, an omnipresent, all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving entity who lives in a causally connected space to us all, but is everywhere and can act upon everything at any time, is very intuitive.
Yeah, exactly, right. It's like it's always the, yeah, the it's exactly, it's a double standard that should be visible from space there. But
I was going to say, like, on skeptical theism, it feels like such a massive disaster for the theist outside of defending them from the problem of evil. Because if you're like, well, you know, how can we know what the result of this would be in the end or whatever, or like why it's permitted? It's like, well, you argue that, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to be gay because God created my penis only for fucking bitches and making babies. It's like, how the fuck do you know?
Yeah, totally, right? Like, this is the, and it's also a bit of a suicide bomb in terms of evidence for theism, right? Like, it certainly deprives you. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe this is a big problem, maybe it isn't, but it certainly deprives you of the ability to use any sort of design or fine tuning argument for the existence of God, because all of these arguments depend on the idea that we would know that God would prefer the universe to be this way rather than this other way. And it's like, well, you know, but by your own lights, you don't know that, right? Like, you're claiming that, you know, you're claiming that we're just not going to be able to fathom the thoughts of God. And if that's true, right, we can't help ourselves to assumptions about what sort of intentions a being like this would have.
Whatever evil the penis in this man's ass causes, in the end, it'll all work out.
Well, can't think of a better note than that.
What's on next week? Oh, we haven't decided.
So if we stay a week behind, it's going to be the one that went up today, which is a sort of friendly, is a friendly but critical intervention on the abortion argument in Norm Finkelstein's book, I'll Burn That Bridge When I Come to It. But if we catch up to the present, that would be, again, I really want to write about Dennett because that New York Times obituary really pissed me off. I was actually sort of thinking of titling the obituary the New York Times piece on Daniel Dennett's grave. But we'll you know, might come up with a different, more tasteful title by the time next Sunday rolls around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very tempted by both ideas, so we'll have to see.
All right, fair enough.
So it feels like the Dennett thing should come next week, right?
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah, it's also possible if we want to do the Norm one at some point that we could do, if we schedule a little out, it's possible we could get the man himself to join us for it. So, that's worth thinking about, but, since we are veering into doing an on-air production meeting, let's maybe
just imagine how long the episode would be if Norm came on.
Also true.
For everyone, you can look forward to that.